So is this probably, well, first of all, thanks to Richard Daniel for inviting me to participate in this summer camp for scientists at PITP. It's really been a lot of fun, and I'm learning a lot. It's probably obvious to you guys, and my disclaimer, you know, I'm a structural biologist, biophysicist, not a population geneticist. So that's why I'm sort of coming from a different angle than most of the people I think in the audience.
Oh, well, that's why we asked you.
That's why I'm here. So I figured I'd give you this overview of things that I can potentially, that I'm planning on talking of, and depending on how the conversation goes, you can decide whether you want me to keep talking or not. In white is where it's really my expertise. I'm going to be talking about the molecular basis of drug resistance and giving you examples of the HIV and hepatitis C proteases. I'll then talk about our strategy of drug design and discuss how we developed novel HIV protease inhibitors that are less susceptible to resistance. That'll be followed by how we selected for resistance and how my collaborator took the inhibitors we developed and did 60 passages, viral passages, with a total of 11 different inhibitors over 2 years and did deep sequencing, and we're in the process of analyzing this data. Then I'll go back to the biophysics and tell you about resistance beyond the active site, the mechanisms of action outside the active site that change the enzyme's dynamics, the physical dynamics of the enzyme and thermodynamics, if you guys can stomach that. And then I'll finally end on another really exciting collaboration on influenza, where we've been studying influenza under a number of different selection pressures in viral culture and doing deep sequencing every step of the way. And so far we've done two drugs, an antibody, another virus. And this is a huge collaborative effort, and I'm one of the directors of the effort, but the people that you guys know more closely are involved in other aspects. So this is as a teaser to what can come ahead. So to give you a feel. So my own research group, so we take a very multidisciplinary approach. We're primarily structural biologists using crystallography and structure-based drug design. We do organic synthesis, thermodynamics and calorimetry, enzyme kinetics, molecular dynamic simulations, and free energy calculations. We collaborate with the informatics, we collaborate with the virology and systems biology. So basically we're trying to think about drug resistance in terms of a new drug design strategy, how to avoid resistance by leveraging evolutionarily constrained places in the drug target, how in quickly evolving diseases to realize that you're dealing with a heterogeneous population from the get-go that is able to accommodate the selective pressure of drug therapy, and how the adaptation is not only restricted to the active site of the drug target, but as an adaptation of the entire system. So that's sort of what we're trying to do in a nutshell. These are the people I have the privilege of working with and who do all the heavy lifting. I'm, as I say, the cheerleader, spokesperson, money getter, mom for all these people. The way we think about resistance is in terms of molecular recognition. So how does a drug target maintain its function while no longer being efficiently inhibited by the drug, and resistance occurring through rapid evolution? And I'm going to argue that a lot of our methods of modern drug design fail to pay attention to the details of the function of the therapeutic target, whether we're using high-throughput screening techniques or structure-based drug design, and leaving opportunities for resistance to occur where we could be more constrained in how we do the design from the get-go. And with the concept that disrupting the drug target's activity is necessary, but not sufficient for developing a robust drug that avoids resistance. So the type of resistance my lab primarily studies is when it occurs, when there's a mutation in the macromolecular drug target that allows the enzyme to continue to function while no longer being efficiently inhibited by the drug. And so I'll just sort of schematically lay out what I mean by this. So if you think about a drug target, and most of the drug targets that we hit are still enzymes that interact with a particular substrate, they make a functional complex, and then the disease progresses, unhappy patient. When we do drug design, whether it's computational or high-throughput screening, we screen a number of inhibitors against our target. If we're lucky, we get a hit, and if we're really lucky, it's bioavailable and all the things that a compound needs to be a viable drug. But if it's a quickly evolving disease, resistance occurs, the inhibitor no longer binds to the target so well, and the enzyme is able to continue to recognize and process substrates. So what we've come up with is sort of a new paradigm in drug design where we pay attention to the details of the enzyme substrate complex, and if the enzyme has multiple substrates, so much the better, because then it's more evolutionarily constrained, and use that as an added constraint in structure-based drug design to have the inhibitors fit within the substrate envelope. A mutation that impacts the inhibitors most likely impacts the recognition and processing of the majority of the substrates. So those inhibitors should not only be potent against the wild type or the main form of the enzyme, but other resistant forms or polymorphisms, and so it should be more potent. So what we're compared to sort of more traditional drug design paradigms where many opportunities are left for resistance to occur on either side of the substrate, we're trying to minimize the chances for resistance to occur. We're not claiming that resistance won't occur. I mean, of course, evolution's going to get around it, but we're trying to make it as evolutionarily constrained as possible in the inhibitor design, again, with this concept that disrupting the drug target's activity is necessary but not sufficient for developing a robust drug that avoids resistance.
And how much evidence is there so far that humans are smarter than evolution in this respect?
Sounds good. Okay, so I'm not claiming that we can get away from resistance entirely, but I think we can be a lot smarter than we currently are. Because we're leaving opportunities for resistance to occur very easily. And I'll show you a few examples of it, and I'll show you an example where it appears to be successful. Okay. So the two systems I'm going to start out with talking about is HIV and hepatitis C. Both of them, as Richard explained with HIV, are very quickly evolving. Both of them are global pandemics. I mean, right now there's 33 million people infected with HIV, and as Alex was describing the other evening, I mean, in South Africa, what did they say, 30% of people are infected with HIV. And there's...
Huh? Not South Africa.
Sorry.
Where I am.
Yeah, where you are in particular, okay,
not
in the city. Alex, please stop. The hepatitis C is even more of an issue globally. I've seen estimates up to 200 million people, and we're going to hear talks tomorrow. Yes, and I'm blanking on. From tomorrow morning, Anna?
Charlotte.
Charlotte. Yes. On HCV tomorrow. But I mean, it's a huge pandemic. It's the leading cause of liver cancer and liver transplant in the U.S. And there's all sorts of complications. Many people are also HIV infected. In both cases, and this slide was for hepatitis C, but there's very proofreading mechanism in both viruses is very low. and you get a very high number of viral quasi-species pre-existing any therapy. And so that sort of makes it ripe for resistance to occur. So this idea of the substrate envelope, how do we apply this in the viral proteases? So in HIV, so here are the crystal structures of the HIV protease and the hepatitis C protease. They play similar roles for the two enzymes, but one's an aspartyl protease, one's a serine protease. This is actually color-coded, the HIV protease, by how much it mutates. Only those residues highlighted here in yellow are conserved. In red, with the sites change shown, are the primary sites of drug resistance. And in dark and light blue are residues that mutate with higher frequency in patients undergoing therapy. This is data from Bob Schaefer, who may make an appearance next week. We're still waiting, hoping. There's some initial work on hepatitis C, and hopefully tomorrow Charlotte will tell us more about the sequencing of the hepatitis C virus in more detail.
So the red residues over there, in the absence of the drug, they are pretty conserved too, right?
They're reasonably conserved in the absence of the drug, but they're sort of the primary sites of drug resistance in that. Most of them are in the active site. So this is my Pac-Man view of HIV protease. HIV protease is a really good drug target because it is responsible for viral maturation. It targets the GAG and GAG-probe polyprotein at a whole series of different sites, 10 different locations, and allows viral maturation. So if you inhibit the protease, you effectively stop my viral maturation. It's a little enzyme. Here it's just schematically shown. It's a symmetric homodimer until it binds substrates or inhibitors, and then it becomes asymmetric. As Richard showed yesterday, I mean, there are many different sites that it has to process in the GAG and GAG-pro-polyproteins, releasing the structural proteins as well as the enzymes within HIV. What was fascinating to me as a molecular biophysicist was that this tiny little enzyme is able to recognize and cleave very specifically 10 very diverse sequences. And these sequences are not very homologous to each other, they're not very symmetric, and yet the enzyme has to recognize them specifically and in a specific temporal order, or the virus is dead. So it's not enough that it's a general protease, and it's not promiscuous. It doesn't miss by one or two residues, even though some of the sequences look like, well, this isn't quite the right alignment. So we were very curious about what do these sequences in common, what was the common molecular recognition motif that the enzyme was recognizing to identify these sequences and substrates. And as structural biologists, what we did was to take the inactive protease and to crystallize it with peptides corresponding to the cleavage sites within the GAG and GAG-pro-polyprotein. And so this is one of such. So with the substrate peptide threading through the active site, these two flaps closing down over the peptide.
And is the configuration the same for all 10?
You can align all 10 to be the same, yes.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, does it bind all 10 in the same way?
Yes. Since it's symmetric, you just align them the same, so they all bind the same.
I mean, in principle, it could be that part of what allows the diverse recognition is that they are bound somewhat differently.
Yeah. No, so they bind in a very highly overlapping manner, and this is how we devised this substrate envelope theory. So this is the superposition of the crystal structures of the different substrates. And what they have in common is a conserved three-dimensional shape, which we've highlighted in blue as the consensus volume here. So this schematic came out of this analysis.
So is there, if you cleave peptides as opposed to cleaving a polyprotein,
yeah,
are rates of cleavages in KM similar? So for example, for CDKs, a large part of their substrate specificity actually comes from things binding to the cyclin. It has nothing to do with the kinase subunit. And that was revealed by exactly the sort of comparison I just described.
Right. No, so generally, but not completely. So it's I mean, if you process just the peptides, you get a pretty good mimic of the rates, but it's not completely. So we're doing some experiments that I wasn't going to tell you about in terms of full length GAG and looking at the coevolution of the enzyme with the substrate and how it is able to recognize. So if we look at more of the details of the structures of the substrates in here, within the substrate envelope, although it's generally sort of an extended conformation, there's subtle nuances of how the packing against P1 and P3 is conserved, sometimes with the backbone rearranging to conserve it, on the prime side, the substrate's more extended. Interestingly, where a particular substrate protrudes out from the substrate envelope, such as this yellow one, there's a phenylalanine that's protruding out at the P1 prime, it contacts a valine in the protease. This valine sometimes mutates to an alanine, and this van der Waals contact is lost. The substrate then co-evolves with P2 becoming a valine and reordering the substrate within the envelope, within the consensus volume. Yeah?
I guess I was going to ask something that you just sort of stated. So how much mutational allowance is there, like based on these sort of peptide? I'm assuming people have done mutations to this peptide region and asked, can you still be
right? It's context dependent. So some things like isoleucine is never tolerated at P2, and so there's some sort of general rules like that. But to get the optimal cleavage, it's really these sites are not independent. So what's happening at the interactions of P1 prime and P3 prime can impact P2, can also impact interactions of P2 prime and P4 prime. So it's the recognition is of the entire. Yeah.
And I just want to here. I just realized that this we're looking in detail at a homodimer. So P1 prime. The amino acids that define that pocket are the same as the ones that define P1.
Right, and the substrates are very much not symmetric. Yeah. Okay, so you know, even though it's a symmetric target, and there was some effort early on to make drugs that were symmetric, it's binding. And the thing to keep in mind, right, is substrate recognition and turnover is a dynamic event. The enzyme's recognizing the substrate transiently and not long enough to cleave it and then release. If it binds too tightly, it's going to inhibitor binding. You're really binding and locking down the enzyme. So it's, you know, there's the recognition payoff. It's two different processes, if you like, yeah, to think. Okay. So a similar story exists within hepatitis C. The viral protease that we're studying, the NS34A, it cleaves a number of sites in the polyprotein. This enzyme is actually a really fascinating enzyme because it's actually connected to another enzyme, a helicase domain. So here's the viral protease, and it's in a single chain with the helicase domain. And there's some theories and some analysis, including from my lab, of the interplay between these two enzymes, and they seem to downregulate each other. But functionally, it's not really understood why the protease should be linked to this helicase enzyme, and the details of what this helicase are doing is still being sorted out. So for purposes of this discussion, we're focusing only on the protease domain of this bifunctional enzyme. And this, again, cleaves a diverse series of sequences. It has more conservation at the P1 and P1 prime region, and interestingly, at P6. But on the prime side or unprime side, there's, you know, one of my students said was alphabet soup, right? So it's really looking for patterns in the sequence. I mean, there's some electronegativity, but some are hydrophobic. There's a proline. I mean, it's very, very hard to see. So we did a similar thing and solved crystal structures of what turned out to be product complexes.
These patterns are reflected in HCV diversity, but so you've taken some consensus sequences here for.
Yeah, this is from the genotype 1A. I don't remember offhand the exact conservation between the different genotypes. I think there's some subtle differences between the different genotypes and different flaviviruses. They're very different. We're looking at dengue, which has a similar bifunctional enzyme, and there the substrates are extremely positively charged, often have an arginine-arginine lysine motif, which is makes it a very difficult drug target because it's so charged. These are the crystal structures of the product complexes from P1 to P6 of this enzyme. We relearned something that was known in the literature for a long time, that in a crystal environment, serine proteases, even if you get rid of all three amino acids of the catalytic triad, will retain some activity by waters essentially playing the role of the oxyanion hold and cleaving the substrate. So we, so far, have made do with product complexes, but we've learned a lot from these already. We were able to do a similar thing as with HIV protease and calculate a substrate envelope by superimposing these crystal structures. Here's the catalytic triad and calculating the substrate envelope. Actually, these three residues in this pinkish color are the three primary sites of drug resistance, arginine at 155, alanine at 156, and aspartic acid at 168. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But here's the substrate envelope of the hepatitis C. So then how do we think about resistance? And in terms of a change in recognition, like I was talking about before, so that resistance occurs in such a way that we retain,
I just have a question regarding something that was asked earlier. So we know that crystal structures sort of constrain the protein's conformational space to a large extent, right? So are you at all worried that maybe the way in which these guys, even though the peptides bind very uniformly, the actual cleavage in different peptides happens in slightly different conformations, allowing for different sort of movement of the corresponding peptide regions?
So, I mean, yes. But the way we've dealt with this, so how it's binding to a peptide compared to a large polyprotein is going to be different anyway. And how it's binding, since we're just looking at the protease domain, even with the helicase domain could be affected. But the details of the recognition of in the substrate binding site is going to be conserved. And what we've done to try to test that is we've done NMR experiments. We've collaborated with NMR, and we see the similar patterns, shifts, chemical shifts in terms of the HSQC. We also do extensive molecular dynamic simulations, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And it stays put. I mean, inhibitor is better than substrates, which, again, getting back to. Although it's a crystalline environment, I mean, protein crystals are very different than small molecule crystals also. So, I mean, they're a large percentage of water. Some of them can have up to 80% water in there. So, yes, it's crystalline, but it's not as homogeneous as you might think. So again, getting back to this figure I showed you briefly earlier from Bob's analysis we did quite a few years ago now with Bob Schaefer, and looking at the where the primary resistance sites are in the active site, and you know how much of this enzyme really mutates, and you know in a patient who is really failing therapy, they can have in their protease gene 99 amino acids up to 25 mutations, right? And it's, the enzyme's still able to recognize and process the substrate. So, you know, it's really a very plastic protein, and can tolerate a lot of changes. And so understanding how these mutations couple together and the mechanisms by which they support each other is something we're trying very hard to work on. These are all the currently FDA-approved HIV protease inhibitors. I apologize if there are any chemists in the audience. I'm not a chemist. But suffice it to say that these are all chemically different compounds. They're all competitive active site inhibitors. And when you superimpose these as they are found in their crystal structures, they superimpose very closely upon each other, making, if you like, an inhibitor envelope. I mean, part of this is in the drug design process. There is companies often refer to as the Me Too drugs. So the one company will design a drug, and another company will design something that's slightly different than that. So if you look at saquinivir and nilfinivir, there's a lot of similarity between them. And that might have a little better bioavailability or a little better potency. But the problem with these Me Too drugs in terms of resistance is the resistance profiles can be overlapped very closely. And so because these inhibitors overlap very closely, that you do get common patterns of resistance coming across you, so you can get resistance to the entire class of protease inhibitors. And so how I came up with the schematic was based directly on the overlay of the inhibitor envelope on the substrate envelope in HIV protease, and where the inhibitors protrude away from the substrate corresponds to the primary drug resistance against those inhibitors seen in the clinic. So this is where, so exactly where the inhibitor sticks out is where the most of the resistance occurs. These inhibitors are sort of color-coded by where they protrude out and listing the exact resistant patterns. The two inhibitors that fit the best within the substrate envelope are ampranivir and darunavir. Darunavir was the most recently approved HIV protease inhibitor, and it's extremely potent. It was approved in 2006. It fits pretty well within the substrate envelope, and it's actually really served as a proof of principle that viable inhibitors can fit within this substrate envelope and be very potent. It was actually first approved for the treatment of patients with high levels of pre-existing resistance. So one of the criticisms when I first proposed the idea of the substrate envelope was that you could only, because substrates bind weakly, you could only get weak binding inhibitors to fit within the envelope. But darunavir actually binds with a 4.5 picomolar affinity, and by calorimetry, it's the most potent of the HIV protease inhibitors. So it's really how the interactions are made more than is it within the substrate binding region or not. So there's this is an extremely enthalpic inhibitor. This is, you know, takes you back to your freshman chemistry classes. And although I'll show you later if there's time, whether we understand entropy and enthalpy, I would argue probably not. We have a lot to learn. But it's very potent, Isabel.
But is it generally true that sort of fitting stuff into the substrate envelope reduces their affinity, and is an exception, or?
I don't think there is rules like that. I think I think it's the chemistry of how you interact with the active site. So I mean, I'm sure being a transition state. Well, all of these are transition state inhibitors. Here are the other some of the others, the thermodynamics, and they're two orders of magnitude weaker in binding affinity. Is this the exception? Well, this is an exceptionally potent inhibitor. And what I've noticed, and I've queried in a number of times, many antibiotics are still in the micromolar inhibition constants, and why should antibiotics that are also targeting enzymes be so much weaker affinity? And of course, if they're weaker affinity, it's easier for resistance to occur as well. So you need more of the drug and all that. So I think getting to a low picomolar inhibitor is exceptional in general, but I think it's worth it. The constraint of the substrate envelope, I don't think, makes it harder or easier to get there.
I mean, how much of a high affinity is just the fact that compared to a floppy peptide, this inhibitor is rigid, and so you're not paying huge entropic costs to bind?
You see that with that these are more entropically driven. You can't easily say that, you know, all of these are rigid, so it's not easy. Yeah.
But all the drugs are relying on competitive inhibition. So you're relying on the fact that they get stuck there because of a higher KD, not because of some cross-linking upon entering.
Right, these are all competitive active site inhibitors. There aren't that many opportunities for covalent linkage elsewhere than allosteric inhibitors for HIV-30. Hepatitis C, I joke that this is my $15 billion slide with all the drugs that are in clinical trial. Actually, this TMC-435 has been approved now. The first two were approved almost 2.5 years ago from Merck and Vertex. And there are also competitive active site inhibitors from and we'll probably hear many more exciting drugs that are coming out on hepatitis C tomorrow. But these compounds, there are a number of different classes. The first two drugs that were approved, it was telaprevir and bosepivir. They're both linear, sort of peptidic compounds. There are two other major classes. There are macrocycles that link P1 and P3 and P2 and P4 in different ways. And so we were curious. There is a lot of cross drug resistance. The three primary sites of drug resistance are these three residues I pointed to in the structure a moment ago, the arginine 155, alanine 156, and aspartic acid 168, which really impact many of the binding of many of the inhibitors. So we were interested in investigating those, and those map right outside the active site to right here, and right next to the substrate envelope. We've looked at actually many of the different inhibitors because they're in clinical trials. We weren't able to actually get most of them. The only one we were able to purchase was telaprevir. The rest we had to make from scratch, and luckily I have a very good organic chemist in my laboratory, Akbar Ali. And Dr. Ali synthesized all these inhibitors and many more from scratch, and with them we were able to do our assays and crystallography. So our collaborators at Monogram Biosciences took a number of these inhibitors. I know it's exciting, but looked at how potent they were. And what we learned was that single site mutations resulted in very different resistance profiles between the different drugs. So very different affinities. So telaprevir actually binds 10,000-fold more weakly than a compound by Merck that's in clinical trials, MK-5172. The tenofovir, which has been developed by Roche, is the arginine 155K is the biggest hit in terms of resistance. Losing three orders of magnitude of binding affinity or more, whereas for the MK-5172, the alanine 156 threonine also knocks out at least three orders of magnitude of binding affinity.
So is this for genotype 1, or?
This was done with genotype 1, yes. Mm-hmm. And we were looking at we haven't done it in the viral replicon with Monogram yet, but we are looking in with a purified enzyme, and I have data that's not in this presentation, but I'm happy to show you again. So
is that y-axis directly a binding measure, or is it something more?
Well, it's IC50, so it's in a viral replicon assay, so it's not quite real virus, but it's a pseudovirus, if you like. And
so do you know that's mediated by binding and not by KCAT?
I mean, we've looked at the KIs, and it's similar to the ICE in pattern, but the absolute magnitude is slightly different.
How much do each of these mutations affect the binding to just the substrate itself, or is it that a flat line? Because presumably, you can compare this now to the two substrates.
Well, telomprevir is the only one that's potentially in a similar binding affinity range as the substrates. And we've looked at product inhibition, and I think it's about 50 micromolar kind of range. I'll show you the actual binding of these inhibitors.
Again, I'm a bit confused. What I'm asking is, so the bottom, I assume, are mutations in the enzyme?
Yes.
So how much do the mutated enzymes bind the actual substrate? So if you look at the Gagpal peptides from earlier.
Yeah, so it's hepatitis C now.
Sorry.
So it has to retain enough activity or the virus is dead.
What I'm asking is, what is the range of that activity, right? Presumably, you can get like a metric of what evolution has to play.
I don't know that for the hepatitis C. We've studied it more with HIV.
So if I were a company, I would optimize the blue, right? So what you care about is that you are produce a product that is better at most kind of HCV out there.
Right.
Some of these drugs, especially the ones which are coming, kind of targeted to the mutants out there, which are
right. The thing is that because of the error prone of hepatitis C, and hepatitis C, someone acquires hepatitis C, they've been infected for 20 or 30 years before they know they even have the virus often, and so they have a huge heterogeneous pool of virus. I've heard estimates, and perhaps Charlotte can give us better insight of, you know, every two mutations already pre-exist pre-therapy. And so it's okay. It's again turning to combination therapy, being, you know, hitting multiple targets and not just the protease is probably necessary. Because, you know, if a small fraction of, you know, this very potent MK5172 pre-exists to have A150-6T, I mean, it's not that the resistant comes up after the fact. Most of it pre-exists. So
I guess to go to the question before, these results are the balance between, a mutation has an effect, and what we see is the balance between the ability to not bind the drug, but still bind to some effect the native substrate, and that sum is what gives rise to the IC50. Determines the IC50.
Right. So the virus has to be viable to get done.
Can I just think for a second? I mean, just it seems like it also speaks to Scott's question that these things are still, that some of the effect that you see here has to reflect the effect on the of the mutation on the ability to bind the substrate.
Yeah.
And also, I'm just surprised that telaprevir, I mean, in some sense, the mutations don't touch it. Like the wild type, the IC50 is already pretty high.
It's so weak, right? Yeah. In drug development, there's two sort of gold standards. It's first to market and best in class. And so telaprevir was first to market.
But the IC50
wasn't bad.
It is a normalized measure. So it doesn't take into consideration what's the fitness cost of the actual mutation. It's inhibiting
I mean, if you look at the data, you know, it's these are all normalized to the drug. I mean, they're all. It's not normalized out. Let's see. The experiments are done in parallel with the three mutants in the wild type, and these are the direct IC50s, the curves. These are direct binding curves measures. So they're not normalized within each experiment.
Yeah, but they're normalized in the sense that you're looking at 50% inhibition of the mutants.
Right.
In fact, the mutants might be less good than the wild type by quite a bit. So you're starting off at a different point.
Yeah, I mean, it's 50%, but they're not significantly less fit. There's a fitness hit, but it's not, I mean, for these guys, they're replicating, they're engineered. And, I mean, that's true for some of the highly mutated, but I know more in HIV than
HIV, I mean, there's a
So we are interpreting these again structurally, and so we solved crystal structures against all these drugs, against wild type and every single site mutant. I'll just show you two of them. This is Dinoprovir, so it has a large moiety sticking off of the P2 group at the proline. Resistance occurs by the single site mutations, arginine 155K, aspartic acid 168A, but it's able to tolerate the A156T. So when we solve the crystal structure of this, we can see this large group coming off the P2 moiety is protruding out of the substrate envelope, and it's packing against, it's making nice aromatic stacking over the arginine at 155K that's involved with this ionic network with aspartic acid 168 and interacting to arginine 123. So if the arginine becomes a lysine, this packing is lost and you get resistance from a single site, and that explains the high level of resistance of the single site mutation. And you can see that, you know, the substrates really are quite a ways away from this arginine. The aspartic acid, it becomes an alanine, you lose this network, and this basket of ionic interactions is essentially broken. You can explain. Well, as the alanine in 156, if it becomes a valine or threonine, there's enough flexibility in the inhibitor to be able to accommodate that, and resistance doesn't occur. In contrast, this is the Merck compound, where it retains activity against the arginine 155K and the aspartic acid 168 alanine, but it has high levels of resistance against alanine 156T. It also has a large moiety sticking off of the P2 proline group, and so, you know, this was a very surprising result from the virologists. But when we solved the crystal structure, it became clear why this was. And in this case, the inhibitor is protruding outside the substrate envelope with this large moiety, but rather than packing against the arginine and aspartic acid, it's packing against the catalytic triad, which, although outside the substrate envelope, it has to be invariant or the enzyme's dead. And so this wasn't done on purpose. Actually, Merck didn't know that this is how this worked until we solved the crystal structures, their cutbacks, and their structural biology was so vast that they hadn't solved the structure themselves. But you can see that with this inhibitor, it has a very rigid macrocycle, and while it's not affected by mutations at the arginine 155 or so much at the aspartic acid 168, it is impacted by this alanine becoming a valine or threonine, because when that mutates, it just pops this very rigid inhibitor outside of the active site. So, I mean, the structures, you know, the crystal structures show that. And so, I mean, this substrate envelope seems to be able to explain sort of the molecular mechanisms of, you know, the differential patterns of resistance, and we can step through and understand a lot of the active site resistance and resistance profiles that are occurring. But the trick is, you know, moving forward, how do we incorporate these ideas into the drug design pathway? And we're currently working with Schrödinger, which is sort of the leading structure-based drug design company that supplies software to many of the major pharmaceutical companies. And they're incorporating the substrate envelope into their software. And we just are being awarded a PO1 that's going to help facilitate this. Part of the way we're doing it is by using a dynamic substrate envelope. So this gets to the earlier question, where we've actually taken the crystal structures and ran molecular dynamics calculations on them and mapped out the dynamic substrate envelope, which is the sort of the consensus volume or average time that the substrate occupies the active site. And so this is sort of a dynamic substrate envelope is better for integrating into structure-based drug design algorithms because it's more like a potential function than with a peptide inside.
And so the volume constraints that are most important here, or
We're looking at the volume, the consensus volume. We have information about the solvent and the interactions. I mean, that's all in there, the charges. I mean, that's. But overall, you know, what we found was because, if you remember the sequence alignment, there is a lot of diversity in charge and shape. So we have, and I mean, that might be a way of fine-tuning this, is looking if there's a consensus charge distribution. We haven't seen that to date. So we haven't, we've mainly made it in terms of a constrained volume. So what this also allows us to do is to doing similar molecular dynamics calculations on the inhibitors. With the inhibitors, they tend to stay much more rigidly in one place. And you can see from the molecular dynamics simulations, we can subtract the difference between the substrate envelope and the inhibitor envelope and see what volume is sort of be untapped by the inhibitors to date. So what's potentially, you know, accessible volumes that could be touched. Another way of looking at this is mapping the van der Waals contact of the substrates and the inhibitors onto the surface of the enzyme. And this is, again, from the molecular dynamics, you know, crystal structures and molecular dynamic simulations. And looking at, you know, which residues are used predominantly by substrates, which are used by inhibitors, and really getting a sense of you know, where are untapped regions, where are overly tapped regions by the inhibitors relative to the substrates, and we can be quite quantitative. Yeah.
It's intuitively clear why the inhibitor shouldn't protrude out of the envelope, but it's not quite as clear why the inhibitor should fully fill the envelope. So when you're talking about untapped regions,
so we're trying. I mean, what we're trying to—it doesn't have to fully fill, but we're
just looking for more candidates.
We're just looking for, you know, right. I mean, how can we retain potent inhibitors in as evolutionarily constrained way as possible? And one thing that the MK5172 showed us is that you can protrude from the envelope, but you have to peck on the catalytic triad. So that's another way of being evolutionarily constrained. That's reasonable, yep. At least. So you know, it's not that the envelope is the cure all for everything, but it's in thinking of incorporating resistance into the early stages of drug design, I think is
I'm not sure I fully parse this slide.
Okay.
So this is for the upper panel.
So this is a quantification of the previous slide of the van der Waals contacts of the substrates. Compared to the inhibitors. So residue by residue. So you notice that, for instance, there's more interactions over here on the inhibitor than it is on the substrate, right? or the lighter color, the arginine 155 is here, is orange, and it's only very tangentially being touched where the substrate's in this light blue. And so that's then being quantified here in terms of the calculated van der Waals contact of, let's see if I can find 155 arginine, where the extensive contacts of the inhibitors being made compared to, I mean, there's still contact, but there's less of this.
I see, so what I should be, basically the difference between these two panels is the room for drug resistance.
Right, so that if there are, there's room and opportunities. I mean, if you see areas that the substrates are contacting, that the inhibitors are not, that's opportunity that might be, you know, maybe more contact should be made to those areas.
I mean, it seems like in a sense there's a new failure mode that you could get into. So imagine you make an inhibitor that is perfectly rigid, fits everything about the substrate binding site, has a femtomolar affinity. But the substrate turns out to bind in a more flexible way.
Yeah.
So you can get mutations that fill in part of the active site and inject the inhibitor, your perfect inhibitor,
right.
But the substrate's more adaptable. So it seems like there's a very fine balancing act.
Oh, absolutely. And depending on how long you want to hear me talk, I'll get to flexibility issues. So we've used this with HIV to design new inhibitors and with hepatitis C, but I'll just limit it to HIV. And this has been a collaboration that started out with these groups and has evolved to a new collaboration that here, this is Woody Sherman's Schrodinger, our bioinformatician is Konstantin Zelenovich, we're working with Dan Boland, and our virologist is Ron Swanstrom, and our NMR spectroscopist to get at dynamics issues is Rieko Ishima, and our organic synthesis is up early. And so we started originally with compounds that were close to darunavir and imprenavir because they already fit well within the substrate envelope. We've made several hundred compounds, solved crystal structures of about 40 of them. The basic idea, again, was to fit them in the substrate envelope. These are our top 10 most potent inhibitors. They're analogs of darunavir, where we've modified these two sites, R1 and R2, basically with using either this or what I call the pitchfork isoleucine or pitchfork type moiety. Again, apologies to the chemists. With darunavir and with these compounds, the BIS-THF group makes them extremely potent. We've solved the crystal structures of these, and these are all 10 crystal structures superimposed. They really lock down the enzyme in terms of its flexibility. They fit well within the substrate envelope, not perfectly, but very well within. And they're extremely potent, binding in the single-digit picomolar against the wild type and resistant forms of the purified enzyme, but also in viral replicons, the IC50. So in black is darunavir, so it's the most potent of the currently FDA-approved drugs, and our 10 compounds are all more potent than darunavir in the viral replicon assay. So they're extremely potent against wild type and resistance, but do lose some affinity like darunavir because they're so close to the
right. So on the right is sort of a heavily mutated.
Yes.
And these are most of the canonical.
Yeah. Sort of darunavir resistant mutations. So.
So is that log order difference at the right between the darunavir and your best clinically important?
I mean, you know, I don't think any of our compounds will be drugs. The market's pretty saturated with protease inhibitors. There's some, I mean, we've talked to many of the pharmaceutical companies, Gilead, Merck, GSK, and everybody said, yeah, nice compound study.
Mm-hmm. Not much.
Yeah, we have our own, and I think that in order, so all HIV protease inhibitors, or almost all, need to be boosted, which means that they're given with a cytochrome P450 inhibitor to keep the them in the blood supply longer. What the community really wants is unboosted protease inhibitors.
So all these profiles seem to be very strongly correlated. So
right.
Systems profile is pretty much the same. For all
so these. These do. I mean, they're chemically very similar compounds, so it's not surprising that the patterns are. But let me. But the patterns against these are similar. But let me.
So basically, what would you need to change? So you have thought about this in your design principle, fitting this to the animal to get some
difference. Yeah. So let me show you the next part, and it's very nuanced, and I don't know the simple answer to that. So what my colleague Ron Swanstrom and his colleague Suk-Pyeong Lee did was they took these 10 darunavir analogs and darunavir, and they put them in viral stock that was in the viral passaging experiments where they had 26 single-site mutations of HIV protease. No wild type, actually, but 26 single-site variants of HIV protease in these viruses, and did a total of 61 passages over 2 years. So this is extremely labor-intensive. And they slowly increased the amount of inhibitor after each passage. And now they've sequenced 4 time points where they deep sequenced the protease gene and did bulk sequencing on the rest of the genome. And so if the final drug concentration they were able to attain after the 61 passages are shown here, 2 of them, they really weren't able to get resistance, the compound 10 and 3. The others, they see different levels of resistance, and actually different patterns come up in the deep sequencing. So this is just the drug concentration as a function of passage. And they tried to start them all at the same concentration. And some they were able to start increasing the concentration of the drug fairly quickly. Others they had to back off on the 3 and 10. They had to back off on the concentrations of the drugs and then slowly escalate it with time. So it's a... by this escalation, they are able to select for resistance over time. So they've only, I'd love them to do more deep sequencing, and I think they will over the time. And they're repeating these experiments to make sure that something wasn't wrong with the experimental setup.
What was the readout? Is it number of infected cells, or is it...
So they basically were... So in each passage, they're harvesting virus from the culture and reinfecting the next set of cells at a constant MOI. So I don't know if that was in the previous. So I think they keep the MOI constant from one passage to reinfecting cells.
Seems like one interpretation of what happened is they started out with too high a concentration of 2 of the inhibitors, the populations crashed, right?
Right.
They needed to use lower concentrations to achieve higher levels of replication because they weren't adequately replicating the virus. And now the slopes after they finished screwing up, recovered from initial error, look like they're about the same.
Yeah,
right.
No, right. So the slopes but at a certain point they weren't able to, they did get some changes, but they are repeating it to make sure that exactly what you're getting at. So
yeah.
I mean, this is unpublished new data. So it's But what they've done is they deep sequence at four different time points from the different drugs. And these are some of the examples that Ron put up. I mean, basically, there's evidence of high levels of recombination. In all of them, there's some percentage of wild type present, which there was no wild type in the original stock. Some percentage have as many as like 11 mutations of a single sequence that's a predominant species, like in the UMAS6. UMAS8 has 10 mutations that's a predominant species. And so you can, you know, here's the one for UMAS6, you can go through and see what, these are just the mutations in the protease gene, but, you know, what 11 mutations simultaneously, you know, coexist at almost 22% of the time. And so, you know, we really can get into the details of how what's happening, but between the four different time points, you can't, there's so much recombination going on that we haven't been able to see anything, and that's why I think we need to look in more details of the different temporal time points in terms of the sequencing. So
kind of here is sort of, that means that
so
a huge number of variants that are very low frequency but collectively add up, as you said.
Right, exactly. So I mean, here's, the wild type is in this light purplish color, and it's at slightly less than 1%. So I mean, you're showing things that exist at the 1% level.
If you compete the wild type with this top line, what do you see?
If you can, you mean isolate this enzyme? So we haven't done that yet.
It might be also some extent true.
Everything, I mean, the wild type is competing in the viral pool, but it's in the presence of drugs, the drug at that time point, it's not out competing. So that
I'm not saying that wild type is better. I'm just saying which ones of these mutations confer your resistance and which ones are maybe more stochastic.
Well, that's some of the challenges we're working on. So what's interesting is that we can sort of classify the patterns of mutations by the drug. So not the different drugs, we sort of roughly see four different pathways, if you like, or patterns, and the this pattern exists for Darunavir in the UMAS6. It comes up UMAS6 much higher level, Darunavir less, but it is seen. And the thing that it has in common is a common R2 group. I mean, they're all very similar inhibitors, but there are distinguishable different patterns that we're beginning to pull out. This one has this isoleucine-like moiety at R1, and a slightly different pattern. So 82 here was a phenylalanine, here 82, which is quite an unusual mutation at 82. And 82 isoleucine is also usually the most common 82 mutation that causes resistances in alanine, and this is the isoleucine. And these were not, neither of these were in the initial viral stock. And then the third group has the pitchfork moiety and doesn't have this pattern so much, but an 85 valine. So it's, you know, they're interesting patterns that seem to be affected by small structural changes. You were getting back to your question. When we looked at the viral isolates from patient samples, you didn't pick up these subtleties by doing the rounds of viral passaging. We can pick up subtle differences in the resistance. So we've, Ron's lab's also done bulk sequencing of the rest of GAG and Paul, and there are mutations that are occurring not only at the cleavage sites, but other places in matrix, capsid, and throughout the genome. And there, you know, we haven't had a chance to analyze this in great detail, but there seem to be conserved patterns between the different groups of inhibitors. And so whether or not these continue to be go on, it will remain to be seen. Again, you know, throughout the virus. So that no drug is almost no mutations. There's some in GAG, but very little in the other enzymes and the GP41.
So sometimes you see sort of convergent mutations at the beginning of, at least like the isoleucine is not, it's like position 20, but the MLP6, you have the phenylalanine at position 1. So that, I guess, is effective. The cleavage site, right?
Here, yes. Yeah. And that's a known, actually, that's a known co-evolving site in the cleavage site that's been observed in viruses. So that's reassuring that we're picking up some of the things. So this is, you know, just very early stages of analysis of this.
How much more do we have? We could, you know, go ahead or take a short break and reconvene.
This is the end of the substrate envelope. I mean, basically, you know, I'm arguing that this is an important part to include in the arsenal of drug design technologies. Again, staying within the envelope is being more constrained. So the two, I have two other sections. One is more on the physical dynamics of the enzyme, getting to the question, and others getting into the influenza. So it's up to you guys. And the influenza is, again, viral passaging and deep sequencing, but with every step of the way. So we can take a break, and those who want to come back, I can talk to. If nobody comes back, that's fine.
So you have you have 10 compounds that you've done.
Yeah.
So is there a reason why you couldn't make a huge library, high throughput version of that? You would have millions of compounds and you would then test them systematically. So is this just, it's not possible?
A big pharma is a different, a small academic research lab, and these are very labor intensive.
So there's no way to do a random mutation library based on those, and then you would select?
Right, no, I mean, these, at least according to my chemists, these are not easily amenable to some CombiChem or being able to do a huge library of different, and also from the virologists. I mean, you know, all of, both the synthesis and the viral passaging are extremely labor intensive. So
what about using all those 10 simultaneously?
So if we mix the inhibitors in the, they do overlap a fair amount. I don't know that you wouldn't be able to pull out these subtleties. I don't know what you would.
Well, I think Vila is just wondering whether there'd be harder to evolve resistance against a cocktail of 10 of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think these 10 are very similar, so yeah. I don't know that it would make.
But you somehow, with your passage experiment, you've shown that they are not the same, though.
They're not the same.
If you have this very correlated profile of resistance, when you use one at a time, but suppose you then do random picks of 4 or 5 and you repeat the experiment, would you see non-additive?
Yeah, that's interesting. Try to convince my virology colleagues. I don't know. I mean, what would be interesting for the statistical analysis afterwards to distinguish real things that are to one, due to one compound versus another, but yeah, I don't know.
Generally, I don't think that's the way the combinatorial strategies are designed. Part of the side effects. So if something's pretty similar, it's going to have similar side effects, similar penetrations. You want to have more flaw in that.
Right, for drug delivery, you want to be hitting different targets so that you're evolutionarily constrained by hitting the different targets simultaneously. But that's different. I think that was different.
I don't see the side effect thing because you would get the total concentration fixed.
Right, but I mean, usually that's not what. So usually you have one, you don't have, well, I mean, maybe you have like small variants of the same compound. I don't know. I mean, usually it's not done that. So usually it's done, you have only one compound, and then you choose another one. And you choose that also because it's side effects and mutational process. It's not consistent as well.
So these are the two topics I haven't. I could talk about one or the other after a break, or both.
So should we come back at 11?
Yeah. Thanks. The flexibility of the enzyme and inhibitor in solution, and or in the cell or wherever virion, and in the complex. And so if any of those change, or a combination of them, that the flexibility of the enzyme, free or bound, changes, that will give lead the to. But you know, but we're trying to understand this. We've been trying, and we see that there are subtle differences. There's a lot of discussion of, well, entropy, enthalpy can be caused by differences in the amount of trapped solvent or ions or different things. But we did much more extensive molecular dynamic simulations of the wild type and the resistant variants. These were 40, 100 nanosecond simulations of fully hydrated enzyme. And we did see differences in the dynamic ensemble that the enzyme was able to attain with the variant having being more rigid compared to the wild type in the unliganded case, and more flexible in the liganded. We also
kind of this question a different way. Let's say you were to design an inhibitor to the mutants. Would it be more difficult to design an inhibitor to the mutant than it is to the wild type?
No, I mean, it shouldn't. I mean, these are just, we don't know how to connect. What we're trying to do is to take this information and be able to start to connect the dots, but we don't know how to do that yet.
So the mutant's not like mutants now non-inhibitable because it's so flexible.
No, it's actually, it seems in the pre-inhibited state, it seems to be more rigid. So the mutations seem to give it some more rigidity. The flaps aren't quite as flexible, but when the inhibitors are bound, it seems to be a little bit more flexible, that it doesn't hold the inhibitors as well in the simulations. We also have a colleague doing NMR spectroscopy, and she sees similar general trends, but we can't say A leads to B equals to C, and that's going to be, I mean, we don't know yet. And that's sort of the challenge, actually, what we're trying to do is can we understand the molecular mechanisms leading to resistance and identify pivotal sites, signatures of resistance, by combining dynamics of resistant variants with structure, kinetics, and thermodynamics into an internally consistent model. And bringing in to account the sequence diversity that we pick up, you know, when we passage the virus in sequencing as well. And that's sort of the, our goal is to take these things together and use informatics analysis to sort of link structure, dynamics, and sequence diversity to the KDs and IC50s. But I mean, this is sort of a new project that we're launching into, that where the bioinformaticians get the challenge of trying to figure out the functions of the two. But I mean, it, you know, with HIV protease, we have such a plethora of data from many different sources that if we focus on this as model system, we have I'm hoping we have a possibility to understand the rules, but we just have bits and pieces. Yeah.
So if you compare structures from proteases of different HIV subtypes, are they all like similarly flexible?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't done extensive simulations, and you know, we've worked. I mean, again, it gets into what's practical for us to handle.
Right.
But I, you know, the enzyme looks pretty much the same. There, the variations in subtypes. I don't have that slide in the stack, but they're mainly on the outside in these regions where we're. So they will affect the inhibitor bindings slightly. They do affect the dynamic ensemble slightly. I mean, it's sort of out. Most of the changes between the different subtypes are sort of in this region. They're outside the active site. But some involve hydrogen bonds that go between the flaps and this beta sheet. So. Okay. So enough biophysics for you guys. All right. So the last area I'll tell you about, and this is more just to give you a flavor of this collaboration, because I'm a little bit peripheral, but I thought that this audience would be excited about it. Is a project that we're doing on influenza, and this is a much bigger project than my own laboratory. And what we're, just to give a little bit, you know, the influenza pandemic happens every year. So, luckily for us, the being vaccinated usually keeps us healthy and that they don't get too pathogenic. But for people with, you know, respiratory problems, such as myself and many other people, it can be a major health problem. All the viruses I've been talking about are RNA viruses. What's interesting about influenza is that it has eight, or one of many things interesting, is eight different segments of RNA are encapsulated into the virion. It has expresses 10 different proteins, and. So what we did with this project, and as I mentioned, it's a huge collaboration. Actually, Bob Finberg, who's the chair of medicine, is the PI of the project, and it is to take influenza and do viral passaging that's done in Jennifer Wong's lab under many different selective pressures, and analyze, then deep sequence this and also do reverse genetics from Tim Kowalik's lab, is provides the molecular virology support, and then produces huge amounts of data that Konstantin Zelovich, Jeff Jensen, and Daniel Caffrey are involved with analyzing and sometimes coming up with complex analyses that are not necessarily consistent with each other. And Dan Bolin, who has developed a reverse genetics way of doing a systematic mutagenesis of key targets and looking at that. And I provide some of the structural interpretations, but also help the communication between the virologist and the bioinformaticians. So sort of as an overview of the project, we've been primarily working in two different strains of influenza, H1N1, H3N2. In both cases, there's many viral passages, either with no selective pressure or with a single selective pressure of either a neuraminidase inhibitor, such as oseltamivir, which is known as Tamiflu, an antibody that's targeting the stalk of the virus, the broadly neutralizing antibody, favipiravir, which is thought to be a polymerase inhibitor. These are increased over time. The virus is allowed to grow with viral passaging. And in this case, deep sequencing is done every single viral passage, and the mutations are analyzed. So it's a huge data set. And just to give you a more virology where these hit, the neuraminidase inhibitors prevent the virus from budding. The polymerase inhibitor is thought to be involved. It's still not positive how the polymerase inhibitor works, or whether it's a polymerase inhibitor, but it's somewhere in here is thought. And then the vaccines prevent entry and prevent the virus from binding and being incorporated.
Sorry, these are passage through?
They are passage through MDCK cells, which is a standard cell line that is used, but they're dog kidney cells.
Right. But you, and so, sorry, but the pressures are two drugs and an antibody, or two drugs and somehow vaccinated MDCK cells?
We haven't done combinations
yet.
Yeah,
that's fine, but.
Two drugs and an antibody. And also, we've also used another virus, so we've mixed the two viruses. Mm-hmm. This was the numbers as of May, where there were, I understand we're over a trillion now, but of total nucleotides that have been sequenced from the two different strains of the virus, which is swamps what's available in the NIH database.
I guess I'm not understanding the first bullet point list here. So you have 332 samples from passages that were seeded with the Brisbane.
Yeah, so these are the more specific details of the H1N1 and the H3N2 strains of the influenza. And the samples that came that were sequenced at this point. So from either with or without drug. Okay. This was back in May. But Constantine made this sort of pictorial schematic, and each of the triangular dots are ones we've sequenced. So and there were, for various reasons, things that weren't, well, economics as well, but this was all funded by DARPA, which is why we were able to do this in the first place, because it's enormously costly.
So were both of your Brisbane viruses always passaged in cells? Have they ever seen an egg?
They were, yes, they have seen an egg. So there was some, Tim's group, together with Dan Caffrey, have looked at some adaptation that occurs in the initial passages, and they've been trying to work up that data of the, avian, if you like, to mammalian transition. And we are picking up changes of it. So yeah, I mean, the lab strains, those are, we are, there is interest in trying to move to more relevant strains, but we're in the process. So the DARPA funding is slowly running out, and we're looking for new avenues to support our habit, I feel like.
And just one more question while we're on the viruses themselves. Is your Brisbane 10 already resistant to oseltamivir?
No, I think it's not.
And you're sequencing the entire genome?
Yes. So I will tell you four stories that are, and I can, for those of you who want to hear more, there's more, but I know I've talked enough today. The first is the reassortment, where we took the two strains and passage them together. So just mix them in equa, I guess molar isn't the right comment, equal portions, and also passage each virus individually. And with the deep sequencing, what we can do, which is cool, is you can, from a series of short reads, you can see whether a sequence part comes from the H3N2 or the H1N1 very definitively for each of the eight segments of the viral genome. So what we see, and I mean, the reassortment has been characterized many times before, but what's nice is that we can look at reassortment temporally as a function of viral passaging and as a function of the proportion of the viral pool over the passaging. And what we see is that six segments from the H3N2 and two segments from H1N1 co-sort. So, and this happens reproducibly. We repeated it a total of four times, and not always exactly the same time, but it's happening reproducibly of this reassortment. What's interesting is that in the process of this reassortment, we are also seeing some specific SNPs that occur with the reassortment. So the fact that the virus is competing with another virus, it's putting a selective pressure with the reassortment. There's also some data that I don't have that we see some evidence of recombination, which has not been thought to happen in influenza. But in the same system, we're able to see it with the deep sequencing, and we're trying to figure out, get that all straightened out. So, I mean, it's sort of an exciting, he's looking.
Well, no, how can you be confident, I mean, about the recombination in terms of, are you getting sufficient read lengths where you can actually?
Yes, yeah, so that's what, I mean, this is basically with the depth of the sequencing, we can uniquely assign to each, to either the H3N2 or H1N1.
So you're saying that you see recombination between H3 and H1, not reassortment, but recombination?
What I'm showing you is the recombination.
You're showing reassortment.
I'm showing you reassortment. What I'm not showing you is that we also see
is recombination.
Evidence of recombination.
And I'm saying, what is that evidence for recombination?
Yeah, I don't have that data. So, I mean, right now we're focusing on the reassortment. We're trying. So one of the things that's been challenging for us is setting up the recombinant virus and being able to, I mean, to show that these are really more fit, we really want to engineer the segment that from into the virus, the back engineer, and that's proved to be challenging. I mean, it's in the works, but it's not. Sometimes informaticians are, well, why is it working? Well, it's experimentally challenging.
How do you know the reassortment? How do you know linkage?
So
how do you tell linkage between, I mean, it's different segments.
So the linkage that the segments are
in the same virus as opposed to two viral particles.
So the population of virus is gone in the combined pool is gone almost exclusively to this combined reassortment. There's no H1N1 alone or H3N2. So we can see it by the percentage them. You know, in the deep sequencing, there's basically all of the HAAMP comes from H1N1, and other six segments are there, and we essentially don't see those segments. These are really short vignettes. So I mean, with us, the Tamavir, we are able to, you know, this is sort of a signature mutation that happened in H1N1 resistance in 2008-2009, and there are people in the audience who knew much better than I do. But then pretty much went away on later. So this was, again, the experiment of done in duplicate of increasing oseltamivir passaging all the way at some points, stopping the drug and seeing what happened. And in terms of nucleotide diversity with the passaging, there wasn't much. I mean, it really, weren't many changes at the nucleotide level with or without drug, but we saw this single site mutation that rose in both of the experiments with drug to fixation with the H274Y, which is right in the active site of neuraminidase with increasing oseltamivir, that didn't occur at any significant level in the absence of drug. When the drug was withdrawn at passage 10, the level of the percentage of H274Y pretty much stayed constant, saying that there was very little fitness impact of this mutation.
Were there any co-mutations that happened with H274Y?
Pretty much not. I mean, it really just came up by itself. And, you know, this was the first experiment we did. You can keep sequencing across the genome, and there's just like one.
And which virus was this in?
This.
I'm sorry, I think it was on a previous slide, but I missed it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the H1N1, right?
I think so, yeah.
And does it have the sort of permissive substitutions that were identified by Jesse Bloom and David Baltimore that allows oseltamivir fitness to arise without a fitness cost?
I don't know. It may.
So that might be something really critical to check out, because there's two amino acid substitutions in neuraminidase,
yeah,
that in that virus allow oseltamivir to arise in a fitness neutral way. But if those two substitutions aren't present, it's incredibly deleterious to acquire H274Y.
Okay.
And
it was mainly sort of
a
stability
factor. It is a stability
factor. I don't know, but the collaborative definitely knows the answer to the question. This is actually one part of the project that has been published. So it came out in Journal of Virology, I think, last year. And so this is just the location of the H274Y, and other groups have crystallized it and explained the pattern. So this next drug is really a fascinating one. It's favipiravir, it's just T705. And it's currently in clinical trials. And my understanding, and you may know better, is that it's from a Japanese company. We appear to see lethal mutagenesis. We're looking for resistance currently. It's thought to be a polymerase, RNA polymerase inhibitor. that it becomes a more purine-like nucleotide. So we did a similar experiment of increasing the level of drug with viral passaging. And in both cases, the culture stopped growing, and we believe it was, we suspect that it might be lethal mutagenesis is maybe the best way to say. So unlike oseltamivir, the nucleotide substitutions were much higher in the presence of favipiravir compared to without. So it seems to be a much higher mutagen. And this is the Kuchbal representation of the mutational pattern. With the different segments of the virus around the outside, and this is in the presence of increasing doses of favipiravir, and you can see that the mutation, it resets rate increases among the segments in a segment-specific way. And if we, if we, you know, the PA has the most increase of frequency mutation. So, you know, it seems that there is an adaptation going on. And if we look sort of segment by segment of mutational rate, there's quite a marked difference in the mutational rate in the presence of favipiravir in the absence.
So in the previous slide, you showed us diversity, essentially. And do you think that is due to the mutagenic effect of the drug, or due to adaptation?
We're trying to sort this out, so it's not clear, and it's not seems to be not trivial to sort out what exactly that question of, you know, is it adapting or is it just a general mutagen? But it's not.
It has hotspots. You know, we have some mutations that appear much more frequently.
Right. So, yeah, this is, you know, having almost weekly conference calls trying to sort this data out and understand how to set up the questions the best possible way. I find it fascinating that if it was a general mutagen, I would have thought that, you know, all segments would be mutated at similar higher levels, but doesn't appear to be the case.
So there might be quite a bit of purifying selection difference across these classes, so that's one thing. But you are saying that you couldn't find the resistant mutation for this, so.
Well, we're.
So far.
We're currently. We're currently looking at the data, and there are various candidates, but. That both Konstantin Zoldovich and Jeff Jensen have pulled out. But what I, as a molecular mechanism person, concerns me is that they're mapping to no two mutations map to the same site, no two mutations map to the same segment when they change the amino acid. So for me, as trying to understand molecular mechanisms, that gets me very nervous because I would like to see some, if we're getting resistance, I would expect that some of the changes would at least be in the same segment. I mean, from a molecular.
How many replicas of these experiments you want?
We've done the two I just showed you so far. We're just going to start. We're going to start go back and try constant drug rather than escalating drug to see my hypothesis is if we keep it a constant drug that you will are more likely to pick up the resistance, and though eventually you might, if it's a general mutagen, also have lethal mutagenesis, it'll just take longer. The virologists are probably gearing up to do that. They're also in the mutations that have been identified, and they're statistically significant, trying to reverse engineer them and see if they show resistance in the naive virus. So we're sort of taking, but that's, as I said before, that's pretty labor intensive. So, I mean, this is based on plaque assays of the virus. And yellow is the untreated viral pool, and this is with increasing drug, and basically, you know, you go to almost no virus by passage 15. So it seems like that's why we are suspicious that of the potential for mutagenesis.
But the no drug titer goes down too, and that's just because there's not a lot of selection.
It bounces around a little bit. It goes down, but these.
Well, it's two log orders.
Yeah. But this goes to?
Yeah. Almost zero.
Zero, yeah. So finally, I'll tell you about another strategy we are doing in this, and this is work from Dan Boland's lab, where he's using a saturating mutagenesis method similar to what you saw from Michael Laub, yes, 2 days ago, where he's in a recombinant virus has made individual mutations in neuraminidase of all possible mutations that would occur for a single codon substitution. And he is able to take those neuraminidase plasmids and combine them with the rest of the genome and co-transfect them into the MDCK cell culture to have a real library of viruses with single site mutations, and then do one passage with and without drug in MDCK cells and use that as a way of figuring out which mutations are the most fit in the presence and absence of drug. He's able to do this for 10 amino acids at a time, segments of 10 amino acids, and he's chose four regions around the active site initially and one region that was outside the active site, or two regions outside the active site as controls, where he's done this mutational path, saturating mutagenesis. And so in this, he's able to, you know, by limiting his library to 10 amino acids and only to single nucleotide codon changes, he's able to get a very high level of reproducibility between the experimental replicates with changes that are synonymous with wild type, being in the absence of drug being the reproducibly the most fit, and stop codons being down here in red, and all the other changes somewhere in between.
So, sorry, did you just tell us what's the readout here? What's on the x and y axis?
So this is two replicates, and what he's doing is he's actually, let's see if it's in the previous slide. So he does deep sequencing to see the frequency of the
one passage and then the change in frequency.
Right. And so he actually looks at how much, what percentage of a particular mutation is in the population. And so here's for a particular series, you know, where green again is a wild type synonymous, so is basically wild type, zero being the wild type level of fitness, and red is basically completely dead, like a stop codon and in between. And so around the active site, he found that very few substitutions are compatible with robust infectivity, and that it's you know, it's very sensitive basically to what's changed. But reassuredly, where there is known variation in the database, sort of from natural variation, he's able to pick up that sort of the sites where he sees compatibility or ability to mutate corresponds very closely with what's seen in the natural variation in the database. So that's reassuring, sort of that the changes he's seeing that are reasonable. What this allows him to do is to very quickly see what a resistant mutation is, because it by plotting in the absence and presence of drug, when resistant mutations pop above the line, so they become more frequent when they exist compared to in absence. And when you combine all the different segments, he's able to pull up all the major resistant mutations from these segments. So, you know, this, I thought this was really cool, and I thought that you guys would enjoy hearing about it. What's even more fascinating, or in addition to being able to pick up the mutations, is that if he slowly increases the level oscillotomovir, it's reflected in the percentage of the population. So here with this N294S, as he increases the level of oscillotomovir, you're showing higher and higher levels of fitness of the resistant mutations. But here's our 292K, which in the absence of oscillotomovir is very deleterious. It never breaks the zero line of being wild-type fitness, but it's increasing. It's clearly like resistance in holding, and in a different context, this is known to be resistant mutation. So it has the potential of being predictive of sites that could be resistant in a different environment. So
well, that zero is of the wild type with no drug.
Correct.
So R292K might already be kicking the wild type's butt, even though in the presence of the drug.
Well, this is in the presence of the drug.
It right, but the zero is, so we're comparing it to the wild type with no drug. So a competition between R292K and the wild type in the presence of a drug, the mutant might win.
Because the wild type's present in this, so
I understand, but you're not showing us what's the effect of the drug on the wild type.
So this one, this one wouldn't go across, right? This wouldn't be on this side of the line. In this context.
Yeah, but where's the wild type in that plot?
So the wild type are the. Not in this plot, is
because the wild type will be
these are sensitive to drug. I mean, this is compared. Yeah, he does. It's not
highlighted.
Because
the wild type will be below the horizontal line. It'll be in the center because there's no drug is by definition zero.
Yeah.
But it'll be below the line in the presence of drug. And so what I'm saying is on this other plot.
Yeah.
That below the lineness could mean that even though this mutant is deleterious relative to wild type in the absence of the drug, it may not be deleterious.
I think my understanding is that the fact that it hasn't crossed the line, and I'm not explaining it right, means that it's not advantageous in this system, but it's becoming more advantageous than in the. So it's really the crossing of this line that shows that it's advantageous on an absolute scheme.
Okay.
So I'm. That's. But this one was a clearly advantageous one, and this one has the potential of becoming advantageous. So I mean that's basically it. But I didn't tell you about we've done similar things with these stalk antibodies, and there we see various changes that we think has to do with the conformational changes of the hemagglutinin. But you know, it's still there's a lot more questions than answers here going on. But we do get adaptation as well, and I mean this is, as I mentioned, a huge collaboration. So I'm one of the team leaders, but it's there's people like Konstantin Zeldovich, Jeff Jensen, Dan Boland, that some of. Dan Caffrey, that some of the people may know, but this is sort of my shtick. One advertising, I started an Institute for Drug Resistance. We have a LinkedIn group. We'd love to keep conversations going. People at this conference are definitely prime people who would be nice to have you involved. And thinking about the parallels of quickly evolving diseases. My lab, who has done all the work from both the first part and the second part, and we've been very lucky and received generous funding from NIH and DARPA and a little bit from Merck. So with that, I made it to lunchtime, I think. So thanks very much for all. Yes.
Curious, Richard yesterday made a point that
HIV, essentially all synonymous mutations are nevertheless non-neutral, okay, selected against because of the secondary structure
of the RNA.
So this thing is also single-stranded RNA, right? Yeah. But one of your slides, I saw that all synonymous things are.
So
is this just because we are sort of on a different scale of fitness resolution?
You know, I think there's a lot we don't know about the RNA structure and what's tolerated and what's not. You know, in the hands of Dan's experiments, the synonymous mutations did come up at similar frequencies. So I would argue that at least in the, I mean, he hasn't done it throughout the, I'm sure parts of the genome are going to be much, are going to be more or less tolerant for changes. And
this is a single passage, right? While the effect that we saw HIV yesterday, we're sort of like,
We're on a different scale of fitness resolution.
At least the influenza data of the global pandemic, you can really see a difference between synonymous and non-synonymous mutations. So they are very different. And they, synonymous ones are quite well explained by just interference and being neutral, how they move. So that's a very different picture.
But there's surely a lot of variation among the genome too, right? It's not that all synonymous mutations are equal.
Yeah, of course not, but there's still a, it's a meaningful notion.
On average, they are not as conservative.
It felt like you should just look at triplets, calling triplets rather than, I mean, as if it always makes a difference what's the.
Well, you know, also in HIV, it's true that most synonymous mutations are not as well conserved as the non-synonymous ones, right? Particular regions where the synonymous are very well conserved. But even where there aren't, you see selection. They're not conserved over sort of hundreds of years, but you see selection against changing them. That doesn't mean they don't change, right?
I mean, influenza mutates, it evolves much, much slower than HIV and hepatitis C.
But see, I can rephrase this question in the context of this largely structural biology talk, right? So yesterday we were happy to accept that mutation, within stem region of RNA should have perhaps a small phenotypic effect. Today we're looking at the same folded back RNA and saying that, well, synonymous is synonymous. So is there a reason to think that it may be different in two different RNA folds?
I mean, it depends a lot on the time scale you look at things. Right? Yeah. If you look at, so in HIV, even the stuff that we are pulling out, you only see over a couple of years, right?
No, I understand. But this is basically a statement that it's a small effect, right? Which is what was reported yesterday. Right. Small effect. And we're just not resolving it.
Basically.
As opposed to the statement that it's a different virus, different RNA, and here there's some others.
I think it's not picking up that subtlety at this experiment.
Even between replicates, there was some noise in the slides she showed. That noise is probably way bigger than the selection coefficient Richard would have to make for synonymous changes.
I'm perfectly happy with that conclusion.
Okay.
The interpretation.
Well, I mean, look across the reference, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the air. Yeah. What's in here? What? Yeah. I was right in thinking you guys wanted to see this data, even though it's not my bread and butter. Yeah.
Mr. Live, consulting is very comprehensive and very vast effort. What are the plans for data release and sharing that you have put in place?
And I think that the databases are, it's going to be set up. I don't know, exact release of how it'll be done, of which, I mean, certainly once it's like at also time of air data we published, the person to direct, I would have you contact Constantine Selvinovich and ask him about, because I don't think our intention is to keep it proprietary in any sense. I don't think DARPA requires us to release it, but I'm sure there's lots more interpretation than what we'll be capable, even within our bioinformaticians, where, as I said, things, but we'll get first crack at the data. But Constantine will be able to tell you about that. Well, thank you so much for you guys staying.